Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Richard Bolds, medical geneticist, director of NeuroAbilities Neurogenomics Program, and chief medical and scientific officer of NeuroNeeds, will join us to discuss extensive DNA sequencing and cyclic vomiting and chronic fatigue, implication for genetics testing and personalized treatment options. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. If you're calling in via phone, please feel free to submit your questions to us by email at info@mitoaction.org. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible at the end of today's presentation. In May 2023, Dr. Bowles and his research group published a scientific paper on the results of 50 people who either had whole exome or whole genome sequencing. About 30 genes were identified that are highly likely or likely to be risk factors for cyclic vomiting syndrome. The vast majority of these genes involved cation channels or mitochondria, suggesting that disease results from a vicious cycle of overexcitation. Dr. Bowles will discuss how genetic information can help find an individual's genetic predisposition towards cyclic vomiting and how that translates to treatment options, including those treatments generally not considered in cyclic vomiting syndrome. Lastly, he will briefly discuss 18 chronic fatigue patients with extensive DNA sequencing. Dr. Bowles is a medical geneticist with expertise in mitochondrial, other metabolic disorders, and channelopathies. He completed medical school at UCLA, a pediatric residency at Harbor UCLA, and a genetics fellowship at Yale. Both Dr. Bowles' clinical focus and research has been on genetics of common chronic neurological disorders, including autism, ADHD, pain, fatigue, and cyclic vomiting. He has over 90 peer-reviewed published papers, including 20 on cyclic vomiting. Dr. Bowles was the medical director of a DNA sequencing laboratory for 6 years. He currently is the director of neurogenomics program at NeuroAbilities, where he applies whole genome DNA sequencing to determine the cause of disease in his patients. Dr. Bowles is also the chief medical and scientific officer of NeuroNeeds, a company that produces natural nutritional products to assist people with neurological conditions, including chronic vomiting syndrome and other conditions listed above. He has been a medical advisor for the CVSA since the 1990s. Dr. Bowles, we're so excited that you're here with us today, and we're so excited all the information that you're going to share with us about cyclic vomiting syndrome and mitochondrial disease and dysfunction. There's a lot to cover, so without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to you. Thanks again for coming.
Oh, thank you. Do you see my slides now?
Not yet.
Okay. That's all I see on my screen. Sorry. Let me end the show and then try to figure out what the problem is here. Now do you see the screen?
Yes. So if you could make it full screen, then we'll
Yeah.
be all set.
There we go.
Perfect. Thank you so
Okay, now
much.
where's that? Okay, there's always something. All right, so I've been told before that my talks are a bit on the complicated side. And so what I have done here is in the bottom left-hand side, after this little heart here, there is the take-home message. So you get like something that I had to be able to fit on one line, which is what I want you to take from the slide. So hopefully there's other information that will be useful on each slide, but if you're looking at the slide and you're wondering what is he trying to say, look at the lower left. Or maybe you want to look at the lower left first to see what I'm going to talk about in that slide, because that's really the take-home message. But hopefully, like I said, there'll be more to it. I have many different hats, as Stephanie already mentioned, and I'm going to show a slide on that. But mostly, I'm a treating physician. I've been a treating physician for over 3 decades. I'm still seeing lots of patients. And so I'm going to start with a case report because I think that the case report form really shows what sequencing can do in terms of diagnosis and treatment, and it gives a lot of what the power is in here. So the first one is when I first saw her, she was 13. And She was had developmental regression in the first grade and recovered from that and was given a diagnosis of autism. So she had autistic regression. She had some processing delays. But her intelligence was normal. Her reading comprehension scores were at grade level, and her math scores were just 1 year behind. So she was intellectually doing very well. Her health was pretty good. You can see here, she did have really severe migraine and chronic fatigue, and that was a major challenge for her. Chronic pain and POTS, and she also had frequent infections. She got a diagnosis, was on IVIG and high-dose steroids. But behind these things, most people would think of her as pretty much a normal girl that was going to class when her fatigue and migraine weren't bad enough and doing grade level on almost everything. Then she got, at age 12 years, she got a respiratory virus, a common cold. Everyone in the family got it. She lost all her academic skills in one day. In fact, her behavior went to the point it was almost catatonic, infantile, but without the smiling or the looking at you. And she had these weird seizure-like events. And the EEG never showed seizure activity. This description I have here, the weird seizure-like events, is what I got from. No one really asked the right questions. Was there always a headache that preceded the seizure event? And was there muscle weakness that was more on one side than the other? She had been, for about a year, she had been with significant intellectual disabilities and behavior that went between being a kindergartner to much less. And that's when I saw her. Well, the diagnosis, just based upon the phenotype or the clinical ones, was hemiplegic migraine or episodic ataxia. These are descriptions, but they really, the same genes cause both, and many people have both, and she had both. And that's generally due to a calcium channelopathy. And I'll get to what that means. That just means bad channels, the calcium channel to the cells not working right. And then here's a description of what the of that what hemiplegic migraine is. Hemiplegic migraine is due to mutations in cation transporter. Cation means positively charged. And here's the main cation: sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium. And here's the main genes that cause hemiplegic migraine: calcium channel A1A, calcium channel A1S, and actually the ATP1A2 pump. So mutations in these three genes are the main cause of hemiplegic migraine. Here are her mutations. She had a mutation in all three of the main genes, which would explain why she had a very severe course and why no one really recognized for what this is. And then here's the bottom line. Variants in cation transporters are common causes of paroxysmal disease. If you don't know what this means, it means episodic. It comes from time to time. The most common paroxysmal disease that people know about is migraine, but there are many, many others. So the interventions were all natural substances and just one medication, the mitochondrial cocktail, multiple vitamins and minerals that are meant to help the mitochondria, and we'll talk about that later, and then potassium chloride, which the potassium goes into the cells and it forces the calcium out. These mutations cause a calcium leak. The calcium gets into the cell gets hyperactive, and you have the disease. The potassium chases the calcium out. I also use the cytisolamide, which goes by the name in the United States of Diamox. It forces potassium into cells. So by giving a large amount of potassium and then forcing it into the cells, I can get rid of the calcium. I also used a lot of magnesium. It's part of the mitochondrial cocktail, because that counteracts the calcium to some degree. At the time that I saw her in February 2020, her academics were tested at kindergarten in reading and first grade in math. A year later, exactly the same test after the treatment, eighth grade in reading and seventh grade in math. By the way, she was in eighth grade at the time, so she went back. She had a full recovery. She went back to reading at her grade level and math 1 year below. So not only did she maintain her level, but she caught up with the 1 year in which she couldn't do anything. Her regressed behavior had resolved and became a normal teenager. Her ataxia, that's the way a drunk or a baby would walk, a toddler, resolved. Her POTS and anxiety dramatically improved. She still has some chronic pain and fatigue, and we're addressing those, but they're markedly better than they were before. So she went from being normal to really being significantly intellectually disabled with a extremely abnormal behavior to being more normal than she ever had before, on finding what the cause was. And again, cation transporter genes are treatable causes of paroxysmal disease. If it comes and it goes, it's often a cation transporter. You've probably been told before, well, that's often mitochondrial, right? If it comes and it goes, well, it is that too, and I'll get to it. It's both. Remember, I did use the mitochondrial cocktail. That was the most important part here. Okay, here's the learning objectives. I want to show you that sequencing can help in diagnosis and in treatment. Those are the main things. And we're talking now about chronic disease. This particular talk is on chronic disorders like cyclic vomiting, in which you have nausea and vomiting, but you also have pain and fatigue, chronic fatigue, but also autism, which I'm going to just say a couple slides on it very quickly, is that if autism has problems that come and go, particularly if you have times of decreased function or deterioration, regression, like this patient did, then it's often a cation problem. So this patient had chronic fatigue, severe nausea and GI problems, but not cyclic vomiting and autism. All of these can be cation problems. One caveat is the majority of the precise diagnoses are not on the laboratory report and require additional review by an expert. Why? Almost all diseases, polygenic and multifactorial. You can look at Alzheimer's, hypertension, that's high blood pressure, diabetes, asthma. It doesn't matter what you look at. Cancer, heart disease, any disorder is going to be polygenic and multifactorial. Everything has a genetic component and environmental components. Many times you think of the genetic components as a loaded gun and the trigger is the environment. But it's more complicated, the interact on that. The genes can be treated. It's not things are written in stone if you have a genetic disorder. In particular, environment turns on and off genes. So environment, in other words, treatment, can make a big difference. But most laboratories are only look for monogenic causes. They are looking for a single mutation, which is so severe that it destroys the genetic function and it causes the disease by itself. Those disorders are important. Some of you in this audience probably have children with monogenic disorders. I'm not discounting that. As a geneticist, I was trained in those. I can see how much genetics helps. But most people don't have monogenic disorders. They have polygenic disorders. There's multiple genetic factors which are the genetic predisposition for a disease. Whether you'll get disease, how bad you'll get disease, depends also on environmental components. The other thing is I want to mention is that if you just sequence the patient, like the one that we just did, that's fine for things like chronic fatigue and pain. But if you're going to do autism, generally you need to do trio sequencing, which includes the parents, because most autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders, including epilepsy, are de novo mutations that are not in the parents. So we have inherited variants that come from the parents, and usually you have some from mom, some from dad, and the kid has the combination of those. Or you can have a de novo variant which comes from neither parent that was just a new mutation. In treatment, I want to show you that whole genome sequencing, WGS, can provide individual treatment options in most people with these conditions. That cation transport, that's a transporter of a positively charged ion, like the calcium channels defects that we just saw in that girl. And energy metabolism, that's where you get to the mitochondrial part here, are the main common pathways. These are the pathways in most of the paroxysmal chronic disease. We have very good treatments for these. And I don't have enough time to go over like 20 case reports or so, but the majority of patients do have treatment and majority of the patients treated do get better. And there are combination products that can cover all of this. So you don't have to give like 20 different products. You can give like two or three. So the bottom line is modern genomics is a powerful tool to treat disease. A lot of people get confused. What's genomics and genetics? Genomics is looking at all of the DNA, and then to look at when you look at all of the DNA and to figure it out from that angle. Where genetics, you look at the patient and then decide what genes you want to test. But in genomics is it's what I do today. I used to do genetics for decades. Now I do genomics. So here's some of the hats. I mentioned that I am a clinician. That's mostly what I was doing for 20 years. I was at Children's Hospital Los Angeles and faculty at University of Southern California, USC. I've been out of there for 10 years now into private world. Academia moved too slowly. It was too glacial and it was too confining for me. It's supposed to be where new ideas come up, but it's just so bureaucratic. I found the corporate world to move much faster because with a startup, you either move fast or you die very quickly. I used to work for NeuroAbilities until Saturday. I got spun off. I forgot to mention it. I'm now the neurogenomics division. Myself and Liz, who is my coordinator, have now spun off, and we're part of molecular and mitochondrial medicine, which some of you might know as my private practice I've had for 10 years now. We do exactly the same thing as we did under NeuroAbilities. It's just that the email will change. It's like Liz at MMM instead of Liz at NeuroAbilities. But anyway, I'll show you that later. I'm also the chief medical officer and scientific officer at NeuroNeeds, which is a startup company that makes products for mitochondrial dysfunction and functional disease and autism. So I have a conflict of interest here. We make energy needs, which is great for mitochondrial disease or mitochondrial dysfunction. I was the medical director of four different DNA labs. And overall for more than a decade and a half. And I was the chief medical officer at Cortigen for 5 years and at Lineagen for 6 months, plus two other labs. That's where I learned how to read the DNA sequencing and do that. Right now, I don't belong to any lab. I ordered from Variantics because I think it's the best lab in the world. And it allows me to go on the back end of the computer and make my own diagnosis. So I can look at all of the DNA myself, not be reliant only on what the report has. Unfortunately, a lot of patients with polygenic disease do not get a diagnosis. Everyone's looking for monogenic disease. When things come and they go, of course, it's never there when you do the test or you see the specialists. And unfortunately, a lot of it gets labeled as Munchausen by proxy or fictitious disorder by proxy or medical child abuse or something. And an unfortunate hat is I've been an expert witness in multiple legal cases, including several that are going on right now in multiple states for medical child abuse. And then, I mean, I was a researcher. I had NIH founding, I had foundation founding, including I got one of the first grant from the UMDF. I was faculty for 20 years. And actually, even though I've been out of academia for 10 years, I'm writing more and better papers than I ever had before because of the ability of whole genome sequencing to really understand what's going on and the corporate world, which can move quickly. This is the machine that makes it all happen. This is a HiSeq 4000. It costs almost $1 million. I used to say $1 million. I think it's discounted now for 900,000, so you can take your deal while it lasts. It's about the size of two refrigerators. This right here looks like a refrigerator. It's the size of a refrigerator, so you can get an idea of the size of this machine. The Human Genome Project did the first human genomes, and it was labs all over the world, tens of billions of dollars, and it took a decade to do the human genome. This machine will read a human genome in 6 hours. It's really amazing how far we came. The Human Genome Project was in the 2000s, like 2000 to 2004 or so, is like when the sequence data came out. Been 20 years. And now we have these machines that can do that. That's why that is really the advantage that we have today. And although we could read a whole genome, but 10 years ago, although it was much more expensive, it's really the interpretation computer algorithms. I have that in a different color here because that's what's different this year than 3 years ago or so. The interpretation computer algorithms allow me to go through the 3 billion base pairs of a child plus the parents in about, 4 hours or so, and generally find the answer. And then I have to look things up and everything. So it's labor intensive. It takes me about 6 hours to do it in all. I mean, it took a group of people all over the world a decade to do it only 20 years ago. So it's really amazing what we can do now. So I'm going to be talking about the clinical impact of what this machine interpretation algorithms can mean in clinical care, because the future is really here today. What I can do today, I would have thought would have been science fiction not that long ago. When I was training in genetics, the sort of stuff that we could do today was the type of thing I thought in Star Trek era would might be possible. Okay, switching gears a little bit. There's a proverb from India that there's the three blind men are feeling different parts of the elephant. And you can see the three parts that they're feeling, and they're describing three completely different animals. And you can imagine that here is the ENT, here is the cardiologist, and here is the GI doctor. And they're seeing different parts of the same patient, and they're describing different disorders. But it's the same elephant. This poor elephant has so many things on him. I could have fit more on, but then it's hard to read. There are about 60 or so chronic functional disorders, and here's some of the more well-known ones or some of the more severe ones. And many of them should probably know about, and some of them you might not think about as being in this area, like autism, depression, anxiety, and ADHD. We're taking off the elephant because there's just only so much room in the poor elephant's head. But you can see that if you have one of these, you're more likely to have another. There are multiple studies that have been done. If you have any one of these, you're likely to have another. And not only that, but your relatives are as well. So these things tend to be comorbid. They tend to occur together because the same problems can predispose towards all of these and more. So you get it within individuals and within families. The other thing is people go in to get care because of the way they feel. They feel fatigued or pain or nausea or depression or anxiety or dizziness or whatever it is. That's why people get care, whether it's a surgeon or a psychiatrist or a counselor, a witch doctor, whatever. All around the world, in all ages, people go because of functional symptomatology. They go because of the way they feel. Sometimes people feel a lump or something like that, but almost everyone goes. Functional symptomatology is medicine. And to dismiss that is to dismiss really what being a doctor is all about. People come in with these things and you need to deal with it. But too often, people come in with these things and no one can figure out what it is, and they're dismissed, or they're even called drug abusers or Munchausers or psychiatric or something else. So functional disease is common and unfunded, very underfunded, and it's the largest elephant in the room, to use another cliche. These disorders here are the number one cause of disability. In other words, days away from school, days away from work in the world. It depends on how you say cancer may or be number one, or functional disease may be number one. Those are the two big ones, but cancer gets a lot of funny. These do not. So cyclic vomiting syndrome is not that rare. In some studies, it's up to 2% of people from European background. I think it's less than some other races, but it occurs all around the world. But I use it as a model disorder because if you have cyclic vomiting syndrome, you're likely to have a lot of things on the elephant, and so are your relatives. To find the genetics of cyclic vomiting syndrome helps me to find the genetics of all of those other things. So what is cyclic vomiting syndrome? It is defined phenotypically. It is defined by not what problem you have, by what you complain of, just like almost everything is. And it's a phenotypic diagnosis, a description. Episodes of nausea and vomiting. So the episodes are almost always abrupt. That means an hour ago, they were not in the episode, although they may have been in a prodrome. Sometimes people feel things beforehand. They're distinct. You know when you're in an episode and when you're not. They're stereotypical. In each individual, every episode's reasonably similar to every other, so though some could be much more severe than other episodes. And of course, they're multiple. It just doesn't happen once or twice, but over and over again. So if you have episodes of nausea and vomiting, that abrupt, distinct, and stereotypical kind of all fit together, you know when it's an episode and you know when it's not an episode. You know when your child or you are in an episode. And they keep happening. And you really don't have a lot of nausea and vomiting between episodes, or you have much less. Most adults with cyclic vomiting syndrome do have nausea between episodes, and that nausea can be severe, but it's not nearly as severe as the ones between episodes. So say it's a 5 out of 10, 3 to 5 out of 10 between episodes, and then it's a 10 out of 10 during episodes. Again, if you have so much nausea and vomiting between episodes, you don't know, the episodes are not abrupt, distinct, or stereotypical. That's really what makes cyclic vomiting syndrome. So now that we've defined it, if you meet that criteria, you have it. You don't need a test. You don't need a doctor to tell you. You have it. You just need a doctor to listen to you and say, yes, that's what it is. But there's many causes of cyclic vomiting syndrome, and I'll show you the most common one, which is cations and mitochondria. There's two papers that have come out. This one right here came out a year ago. And that is a scientific one. This really goes over the genes that predispose towards cyclic vomiting. I'm going to say predispose because genetics do not cause disease. Genetics are the predisposition for which disease will occur under the right circumstances, in other words, environment. And then there's a paper that just came out that is case reports to help doctors use this technically very technical information to try to understand it better and to have case reports and how they can use it in treatment. And I'm going to get this is really hard to find online. I'm having trouble with the journal to make it more easier. I'm going to give this paper to MitoAction so that hopefully you can put it on your site so that everyone can get it. A lot of technical data. This is what's in the paper. But I just want to show you, if you have cyclic vomiting syndrome, all of these are very common. In fact, pain, 75% of them, GI problems other than nausea and vomiting during episodes, you know, over 70%, dysautonomia, over 70%, sleep problems, over 50%, psychological, almost all anxiety disorder, 68%, neurological problems, 68%. You get the idea, these people just don't have episodes of cyclic vomiting. That's actually very rare. If you have cyclic vomiting syndrome, you generally have a lot of these. You might have all of these. And then neurodevelopmental disorders, that's 40%. Certainly 60% don't, but things like is neurodevelopmental disorders are very common, ADHD being the most common. It's not only are these are common in the patient, but they're common in the relatives. This indicates that all of this, cyclic vomiting, all of this, including autism, have shared genetic factors. And that's really what this talk is about. Well, this is the paper that came out a year ago, and this is very complex. But what I'm going to show you, these are the genes that were found to predispose towards cyclic vomiting syndrome. And a lot of people have variants in more than one of them. And here's scores, and here's what the gene does, and here's what the pro here's you know where the gene is, I'm sorry, expressed, what cells is expressed in, and here's what the protein does. This is all very complicated. This is not what I want to show you. I want to show you these arrows. Cation transporters move cations across membranes. Either they're facilitated and they just flow across, or they pump them across. So all of the solid blues are cation transporters. That's quite a lot. The light blues are genes that are not the transporter themselves, but indirectly affect the transporter. They regulate the transport in some ways, quite a bit more. These are the mitochondrial genes. If you have one of these, you have a mitochondrial disorder because you have a defect of energy metabolism, which is genetically derived. So there's a bunch of energy genes here, including this one here, the mitochondrial DNA is really 37 genes. So, I mean, I put it all here, it won't all fit, but this is a big one here. So mitochondrial DNA disorders, and then there's many other ones, TRAP1, this is the glucose transporter. This is POLG. This is the gene that replicates mitochondrial DNA and proofreads it. These ones here are indirectly associated with energy metabolism. So they're not actually genes that make energy, but they're genes that are involved in regulating energy metabolism in some way. And you can see there's quite a few of those. And then there's two that are involved in autoinflammation. But they themselves are also indirectly associated with energy metabolism. So the thing to show you is every single one of these is either involved with moving cations or with energy metabolism, directly or indirectly. So are there two different causes of cyclic vomiting? Not really. First of all, the mitochondrial connection has been published many times. These are just my papers. The PubMed identification number, if you just put this into Google exactly like this, you can get the paper. This is the most recent one, the one that I'm showing you the data from. So many, many papers have shown that mitochondrial dysfunction can cause or can contribute to CVS. That's not new. The cation one is fairly new. So there's one cause of CVS, and it's a vicious cycle. If you have a mitochondrial energy problem, you cannot pump the cations out fast enough. The way that a nerve cell fires is that a cation channel will open up. Let's say a sodium channel. Sodium will go in because sodium is at a high percent. Sodium is about 20 times or so higher in concentration outside of the cell than it is inside the cell. So if you open the door, it will come in. It's like in the winter, if you open the door of the house, more cold air is going to come in than hot air is going to, you know, it's then it, you're going to get the house is going to get cold pretty quickly. So the cation channel opens, the cation like sodium rushes in. Sodium is positively charged. That's what it means by being a cation. Positively charged cells are hyperactive. They do things. A nerve cell sends an impulse. A muscle cell twitches. An endocrine cell secretes hormone. When cells are positively charged, they do what they're supposed to do. That's telling the cell, okay, this is your job, do it now. So when the cations rush in, the cell becomes positively charged and it does what it's supposed to do. Then the cations are pumped back out again and the cell resets itself to be able to go again. Like in muscle, you need to reset yourself so that you can flex a muscle again. In nerve, you need to reset yourself so you can send another impulse. So when the cation channel opens, the cell becomes positive and it's pumped out using mitochondria. But what if you have a leak in a cation channel? If you have a leak, then the cell is, you have positive charges always go into the cell. That makes the cell hyperactive because it's always more positive than it should be. Hyperactive cells do more. They send more impulses, false or exaggerated impulses. They also need more energy because the cell's more active. It's doing its thing much more often. Those things affect energy. Hyperactive cells need more energy, and it takes a lot of energy to pump it back out. So if you have a cation leak, you have mitochondrial dysfunction. Not because you can't make enough energy, but because you use the energy to pump it out and you need more energy in a hyperactive cell. It's like for the energy grid. You can have a brownout whether you have a very you have three power plants which are offline, supply, or if you have the hottest day of the year, demand. Of course, you have a little bit of both, that will do it even more. So this causes mitochondrial dysfunction. That's not mitochondrial disease. The cell doesn't know the difference. It has no ATP. It has no energy. It has disease. The same disease with the same treatment, the same symptoms. It's just due to the demand side, not the supply side. So if you have a cation leak, you get mitochondrial dysfunction. But now you have mitochondrial dysfunction, so you can't. If you have the cell is rapidly firing, like in stress, psychological or physiological stress, cell is firing rapidly, you can't pump it out fast enough, so you have a cation problem because you can't get it out. Okay, you have a mitochondrial problem, a genetic mitochondrial problem, a cell that's rapidly firing, you can't get rid of the cations fast enough. So you have too much cation in the cell, which is the same thing as a cation leak. The cell is positively charged and hyperexcitable. Now the cell's hyperexcitable, it needs even more energy, and you have more energy deficiency. See, it doesn't matter where you start. You have an episode, and the episode continues. Cations cause mito causes cations. You can have a mutation here, you can have a mutation here, or what I often see is some mutation here and some mutation there, supply and demand side problems. And then remember, I showed you a lot of this is indirect genes. So what do they do? They affect here. Genes that affect the ability to break down mitochondria, mitophagy, eating mitochondria enter here, including a lot of genes involved in axonal transport, and genes that are involved in neuroinflammation. They come in under mitophagy. And then some of them come in here. If you can't make the cation genes correctly, they come in here. So many of the other ones are indirect, but it goes to a vicious cycle. So people are often looking for what is the cause of the mitochondrial disease. It may be on the demand side, might on the supply side, or it may be polymorphisms in order, in other words, normal sequence variants that affect energy metabolism a little bit. And normal sequence variants that affect cations a little bit, a little leak. The two of them together, plus environment, maybe a little extra genetic involvement, can cause disease. There isn't always a cause of disease. In fact, most people with most disorders do not have a cause. They have factors, genetic and environmental, that contribute to disease. As long as everyone thinks that there's a cause of the disease, we're going to be trapped in the past. So why cyclic vomiting? Wouldn't that be for every cell? Well, I know this is really complicated and everything, but all of the genes I showed you are on this diagram, and I can't go through. I don't have time to go through this, but the problem appears to be in the vagal cells. The vagal afferent means the sensory cell that takes information from the gut and then goes to the brainstem. This cell plus its connections in the brainstem seem to be the place where you have cyclic vomiting, and I think probably chronic fatigue syndrome as well. And it affects the neurons and the glia, the helper cells. What is nausea and vomiting? Well, before refrigerators, people would kill things and eat things off the ground. And it might have been poisoned, a plant or a poisonous or a frog or something. And it might be rancid, full of bacteria. And if you eat the wrong thing, the gut is supposed to say, oh, whoops, that's bad, sends a signal to the brainstem. Some of that signal goes back to the gut to cause vomiting, to get it out. It can also cause diarrhea if it's gone too far, to get it out. And some of that goes to the brain as nausea, and it says, don't ever eat that again. This is a normal situation, but in cellular hyperexcitability, normal food, normal digestive juices that are just there, the enzymes which are always there, can set off this whole system to that you're like you're being poisoned or that you ate something that's rancid. And it just doesn't stop for a while. So that's where it is. And this is important because the brainstem is behind the blood-brain barrier. And so you need to get the treatment into the brain, and that adds a little bit of extra complexity, which I'll get to later. Another case report. Ryan presented as a teenager with episodes of vomiting, headache, and dizziness. When he got to the point that he can explain himself more, he would say he was nauseous. And they would last for 5 days. And every episode, he was 3 days in the hospital with just horrible vomiting and would get very dehydrated. The episodes occurred every 90 days, like clockwork. They were never less than 88, and they were never more than 92. They were 89 to 91 almost always, and 90 days exactly, more than half the time. You can imagine what most doctors thought about this. Of course, it's either abuse or drugs or psychiatric or something like that. Because how would the mom know exactly the day he's going to vomit? Okay. This is cl a clockwork case. Many of the cases are clockwork. They're harder to treat. But if you know the genetic cause, they can be treated. He had ketones during episodes. They always settle that starvation because he's not eating. But why was he ketosis after the first vomit? That's because of mitochondrial dysfunction. He also had some other issues. I told you that this is that cyclic vomiting really is a good model for other things. Frequent urination or interstitial cystitis is just hyperexcitability of the neurons that say your bladder is full. Constipation, again, that's a GI problem, and then chronic fatigue again. It's very rare that someone will just have cyclic vomiting, almost always something else, and that's reflux. The cyclic vomiting episodes were not the thing that bothered the family the most. They were the random, aggressive, explosive disorders. This is a big guy. He's like almost 200 pounds and is all muscle. When he would go into an explosive episode, completely at random, not because he didn't get what he wanted, out of the blue, it was very dangerous for his family. His father had to be there all the time. He couldn't be with his mother alone. His father's also a big guy. It can hold him down. But often it took two or three people to keep him from hurting himself, destroying property and others. Because of that, he was going to have to be institutionalized, basically drugged and bound. And he failed treatment with all of the major stuff. All of the major things for cyclic vomiting, nothing made any difference. 90 days, he was going to have his episode. Okay, we did genetic testing and I found a variant in sodium channel 4A. Now, 1.2% of the population, that's 1 in 80 people, have that variant. This is a normal polymorphism. Certainly, the lab didn't say anything about it, they just glossed over it entirely. But I knew when I found that how to treat him. Again, genetic background can be fairly common causes. It's the combination of the genetic background and the environment which predisposes towards disease. So when I got this, I put him on a high potassium diet and gave him acetazolamide to force it into cells. The episode stopped. It's been 7 years. He has not had a single episode. But not only that, his aggressive behaviors, well, I mean, if you trigger him bad enough, he might get a little bit, but very, very mild. No longer is he violent in any way. Those aggressive behaviors that that were out of the blue have completely stopped. So he can now live in a supervised group home, but he has a roommate, he has a job, he goes by bus. Yeah, he has a degree of intellectual disability and he's not going to fill out his tax report and everything, but he has a significantly better life than he would have because of finding a common polymorphism. That's what it's important to look at the underlying genetic sequence. It's not always the rare variants that are important. Okay, chronic fatigue syndrome. There are studies that have shown in the US as many as 3% of people meet criteria for chronic fatigue syndrome. It is extreme, but it's usually not diagnosed. I have done, even in the general pediatric clinic, I've seen many, many cases that go back and forth all the time and no one figured out what it is. This is paraphrased from the CDC, the Centers of Disease Control. And it's basically if you're tired enough to it, that it's life altering, that you have severe enough that it really affects your life in a significant way. If you have post-exertional malaise, in other words, if you overdo it one day, and overdoing it can be like washing the dishes for some people, you pay for it the next day, significantly later in bed the next day. And even after a good night's sleep, or you never sleep at all, you're still tired. That really is what chronic fatigue syndrome is. See, every disease pretty much has fatigue because fatigue is the key to the animal to curl up in a ball, sit under a rock, get better. Not to use his energy to go running around finding food or mates or just to play, but to use his energy for healing. So almost all will have that. But in other disorders, if you're active during the day, you pay for it then, the rest of the day, not the next day. And if you have a good night's sleep, you're okay for a while, and then you get tired later. That's what makes it chronic fatigue syndrome. And in the other side of the pond in Britain, they call it myalgic encephalomyelitis. Neither of those words are really all that good, so we often just put them together and call it this. Again, like everything else, there's genetic and environmental factors. And instead of putting on an elephant, this is on Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. Same things as you saw on the elephant, pretty much. These are very, very common comorbidities. in chronic fatigue syndrome. Now I've sequenced a lot, and but I'm working now on another autism paper, and once I've done that, I'm going to try to get to bring this up to 50. But right now I've analyzed, and it's on the NeuroNeeds website, 18 unrelated individuals, they're not in the same family, that meet this criteria for chronic fatigue syndrome. The rest of the data looks pretty similar, but I haven't crunched it yet. Quite a bit of an age range. I am a pediatrician, so I see mostly young adults, children, adolescents. Females to male ratio is a little bit high, as it usually is. 16 of the 18 actually meet diagnostic criteria. The other two probably do, but I just didn't have enough data. Usually, I didn't ask the question about non-refresh sleep. They probably have it. All 18 had GI problems, 17 had dysautonomia, 16 had chronic pain, 15 had cognitive problems, 14 had sleep problems. That's like nightmares and sleepwalking, it's parasomnias. But you get the idea. 10 out of 18 had anxiety. Even frequent urination was, I mean, a third of them. If you have chronic fatigue syndrome, you're likely to have these things, the same thing as it was on the elephant, the same comorbidities. So it probably has the same genetic factors. At least they overlap. I don't have really time to go into this in detail, but suffice to say, I found a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant. That means a variant that can be considered to be disease-related in two-thirds. I found additional diagnostic variants that were not pathogenic or likely pathogenic in half. That's over 100% because most people have more than one variant. There were 21 of these variants in 18 patients, and 16 of the 18 patients had at least one of these. And here are the clinical diagnostic variants. All of the green are channels, and the blue is the pump, the same pump as you saw that was in my patient at the very beginning. And then these are genes that indirectly affect energy metabolism or cation channels. And they're de novo in syndromic patients. But chronic fatigue syndrome appears to have a major ion channel problem. There's also a lot of energy metabolism, not as much as the cations, but 15 out of 18 had either a cation problem or an energy metabolism problem. Now, remember, the cation channels cause energy deficiency by on the demand side, and they're treated with mitochondrial cocktail. So 15 of the 18 had mitochondrial dysfunction. The other three had neuroinflammatory problems. I'm going to, and by the way, I don't have really time to go over this, but you can treat these disorders. Chronic fatigue is hard to treat, but almost everyone gets better if you find the underlying molecular mechanisms and you address those. And I'm going to get to the treatments later. I don't have the time to go over autism. Just want to show this paper came up in January. Two-thirds of the case by trio. I have to use the parents as well. The yellows here are de novo mutations, mutations not found in the parents. The whites here is I didn't find a number one. I didn't find a primary mutation, but you can see most of the whites I found other things, often in ion channels. And then the ones that are in color here are Mendelian. So two-thirds of autism, I found basically a genetic cause. Autism is more monogenic than chronic fatigue or cyclic vomiting, but it's still very polygenic as well. In other words, there's often a single gene, which is the lion's share, and then other genes that contribute. Many of these are the ones that are treatable. Here are the most of them were not on the lab report. I found them when I went through the back end of the computer, and that's because they're new disorders that had never been found before. Because there are thousands of genes that cause autism, and we haven't found probably even nearly half of them yet. But and the paper really goes over the proof that these are new disorders. But these are the main pathways in autism, and you see cations and then mitochondria are the two top ones. The ones that are in green here are treatable pathways. The ones that are in less green are less treatable, but I oftentimes can treat those, and sometimes I can't, maybe 50-50. But the ones that are in dark green, I can treat the vast majority. And so there's a lot of pathways, and there's many others that aren't on here. I mean, like there's methylation and inflammation and cytoskeleton and cellular migration. Those were not as important in these 50 patients, but they are also autism pathways, and some of them are treatable and some of them are not. But the main thing here is that the two most, these are really important. And that is why autism and functional disease often are seen in the same people, like the first case that I showed you. In fact, both cases I showed you had autism and chronic fatigue and other functional problems because they have these things in common. Cations. How do you treat it? There's a lot of treatments. First and foremost, the mitochondrial cocktail, because you need the energy to be able to pump those cations back. Magnesium, which is antagonistic to calcium. Potassium, which I'll get to in the next slide, that's the most important treatment. This gets into a lot of different things, but the neurotransmitters are really important. If you run out of energy, the inhibitory neurotransmitters run out first, right? Toddler in the cookie. Toddler says, "Mom, I want a cookie." "No, 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 I want a cookie." Okay, that cookie is gone. You have to say no over and over again. If you say yes once, it's gone. The inhibitory neurons are constantly firing. They're what we call tonic. They're always on. The second the inhibitory neurons turn off, the excitatory neuron goes. The inhibitory neurons are the ones that run out of energy. That's why in mitochondrial disease and mitochondrial dysfunction, why you the kid has a lot of energy, even though the cells don't. What do I mean by a lot of energy? Anxiety. ADHD type things, autism, migraine, confusion state, psychosis, epilepsy, any of those things. If cells are rapid are firing in willy-nilly in the nervous system, you can get false pain, false nausea, false dizziness, but also false feelings and thoughts. So they can have like even like psychosis, hallucinations and things because of cells that are firing that aren't supposed to. But anyway, and then the medications, there's many, many medications that act on channels either directly or indirectly. One of the major inhibitory neurotransmitters is GABA, you know about that, but serotonin is also another one. And so 5-HTP is one. So these are the things that act on cation channels. These are often used in functional disease and in autism and other neurodevelopmental diseases because of their action on cations. By the way, this is a picture of what the calcium channel A1A looks like. Potassium is a really major thing. All of these foods here, most of which are pretty yummy, are high potassium. Some kids don't necessarily like a high potassium diet. A lot of adults do. There's many, many other foods that are high potassium. High potassium foods and/or supplements are a common treatment for cation channelopathies. The problem is that you need a huge dose. Most of my patients are on between 20 and 40 milliequivalents each dose, three times a day. By the way, one milliequivalent is 40 milligrams. It's actually 39, but for the calculations, use 40. And so you need a lot of potassium. I start at 10 once a day, 10 twice a day, 10 three times a day, and then I work my way up. Potassium can cause nausea. That's a major issue here. But pomegranate juice is really high in potassium. That's a good way to get it. I like blood levels between 4.5 and 5.3, which is on the upper side of the normal range. If it dips into the threes, you often have problems, like cyclic vomiting episodes or crashes, even though the high threes are normal. In the low fours, which is the middle of the normal range, it can dip into the threes and you can have symptoms. So I like it in the high end of the normal range. Anyway, some people can get there by diet, some especially if they get a lot of pomegranate juice. Usually it requires medication, prescription dosing, which requires a physician, which of course you'll need for the blood test anyway. But this is a very powerful treatment, and families can try it just by making sure that at three times a day they've had a good portion of this. So, some for breakfast, you can have apricots and bananas. For lunch, you can have guacamole and a salad with spinach and potatoes, maybe. And for dinner, you can have maybe salmon and potatoes and maybe some nuts or something. I mean, there's many different ways to get there. Energy metabolism. This is actually on the website for the neuroneeds.com. All of these are parts of the mitochondrial cocktail that have been proven to be helpful in autism. But I also find that they're also helpful in cyclic vomiting syndrome, even though almost none of them have been studied. The only ones that have really been studied are coenzyme Q10 and carnitine because I studied them myself. Otherwise, and there's one other carnitine paper, but really none of them have been studied in cyclic vomiting, and they have almost not been studied at all in chronic fatigue syndrome. But these have all been shown to be useful in autism. If on the website, if you click on any one of these, you can get the data. And these are also parts of the mitochondrial cocktail, which have not been shown to be part in autism, but I think are likely helpful. And so before combination supplements, you would have to try all of these. Have to do one after another, and you have to use a whole lot of them. The reason for that, first of all, the sharks are telling you something. I'm going to be a shark here. So Krebs cycle, electron transport chain, that's what you learn in biology class, right? This is what it really looks like. This is a false color computer graphic, but this is an actual photo of the electron transport chain and the Krebs cycle, which are integrated together, plus many other enzymes. It's crystallized on the inner mitochondrial membrane. These do not float in solution. It's crystallized in an assembly line. Electrons start at one end and they go to the other end. They don't have to find one enzyme, then find another enzyme. Here's some assembly lines. What if you gave this guy his vitamins so he made cars twice as fast? You're going to cause chaos. You're not going to make twice as many cars. What if you gave this machine twice as much electricity? You're going to have major chaos. You're not making more cars. The idea of giving 3,000 times the recommended daily allowance, the RDA, of one of these things, and to see if that works, not only doesn't often work, but it causes chaos. You get side effects. What you really want is to give all of them a little bit of vitamins instead of giving this one guy a huge amount, or give all of these a little bit of a boost instead of giving one a huge amount. And that's where the combination products go in. My recommendation is a high-powered mitochondrial cocktail multivitamin and mineral supplement. Dosing is based on the weight. I do check carnitine levels and 25 hydroxy vitamin D levels because occasionally you need more carnitine. Oftentimes you need more vitamin D. Ubiquinol is a form of CoQ. I'll get to that. I check blood levels as well. And you need omega-3 fatty acids, which I'll get to. And then sometimes there are other things too, but diet and supplements are both necessary and they're synergistic. A good diet isn't going to do it because the supplements that I use are much, much higher than you can ever get in a good diet, even a perfect diet. And yet there are many things in food that aren't in supplements. So you really need it synergistic. And of course, the get out of jail card thing here is that you need to talk to your physician. You need to be okay with that. You can't just take it from somebody you heard from me or anyone else on the internet or whatever. When I'm talking, if you're a physician, then great. Use this advice, hopefully, to help your families that you treat. But if you're a parent, this is something to discuss with your physician. Mitochondrial cocktail is all of this: cofactors, vitamins, minerals, other things. It's used to push metabolism in the direction of healing. It also there's a lot of vitamin deficiencies in people with certain disorders like cyclic vomiting and autism in particular. But the main thing is to push the stoichiometrically to push the reaction in the direction that you want by giving a whole bunch of one thing to make the mitochondria not only work better, but to detoxify the mitochondria from things that happen in energy metabolism when you don't make enough energy. You make half-burn fuel, just like a car when it's going uphill, going fast or something, it's going to make more pollution. Same thing with the body. You're trying to make more energy than you can, you're going to have pollution. Those need to be removed. And many times it's those prooxidants, reactive oxygen species, et cetera, which cause the damage and the disease. There are different manufacturers. There are different companies that make it. This is my solution, powder form. lemon and berry flavored. 33 active ingredients. Most of them work in the mitochondria. The rest of them are multivitamin and minerals, so you don't need that. This is for older kids, age 10 or older, that can swallow powder in capsules. It's also better for older ones. It's a little bit more formulated for older kids, adolescents, and adults. 40 active ingredients. But again, there are other brands, and I would choose one of these three to get all of this. Coenzyme Q10 is probably the most important single one. It is the actual physical chemical which takes electron from one place to another on the electron transport chain. Electrons can't just bounce from place to place in the assembly line. They need to be carried from one part to the other. And CoQ is a crane. It picks up the electron from one and adds it to the other, basically. And that's how it gets from place to place on there. And CoQ is also an incredibly good antioxidant. The problem with CoQ is that it's very poorly bioavailable. Almost all of the Qs in a regular store, in a drugstore, are useless. I have tried them in my patients. The blood levels do not go up, or they go up only a slight bit on huge amounts. First of all, you need ubiquin. You need ubiquinone, ubiquinol here. Sorry. This one here, ubiquinol. Not ubiquinone. You see, they're very similar in name. Most CoQs will just say coenzyme Q10 or CoQ. If it's ubiquinol, it costs twice as much usually, and it will say ubiquinol on it. But the drugstores like to sell this. This is cheaper. But this is five times more bioavailable. That means it's cheaper to get the same blood level, but it's an expensive product, so people don't want to buy it. You need a lot less of this. Some are in soy oil, some are in limonene oil. That's the lemon peel oil. And then some, and this is my solution for that, but there are others out there. There are little gel capsules. If your child can't swallow little gel capsules and you don't think your child can learn, you have two options. You can either cut these. There's a liquid inside that's easy to put in, but CoQ tastes bad. You have to flavor it. And there is one brand out there that has a liquid CoQ. Epic for Health has it. It's expensive and the taste is not that great, but remember, the chemical just tastes really horrible. In adults and adolescents, I use two of them in the morning, two of them in the evening. In school-age kids, I use one in the morning, one in the evening. The middle-age kids, you can tell two in the morning, one in the evening. And of course, little kids will be less. Omega-3s, I'm almost done, by the way. Omega-3s are, we don't need enough of them in our diet. They're in plankton. They're in the little things that swim in the ocean, so it gets into the food chain. So if you're eating a lot of fish or krill, you know, shrimp, you're getting it, but you're also getting a lot of mercury, and most people don't eat very much of that. But it is on land, but it's in the dirt, it's in the fungus, it's in the mold, it's in the mildew. Cavemen ate a lot of that stuff. They didn't wash their hands. They got omega-3s, but in factory farming and everything, it's all removed. There's very little omega-3s. It's really important for brain function, heart function, for the rest of it. The problem is that fish oil does not cross into the brain, and that's the point of autism, cyclic vomiting syndrome, and chronic fatigue syndrome. It's in the brainstem. You need to get it across the blood-brain barrier. You need krill oil. But fish oil is great for the heart. So my solution is to mix fish and krill oil together with sunflower seed derived phosphatidylserine, which is great for also. So this is fish plus krill, plus sunflower seed. Adolescents and adults get one twice a day. School-age kids get one once a day. And this is good for omega-3s are good for brain growth. They're good for mitochondrial function, and they also have anti-inflammatory effects. It's one of the other pathways that, and all of those things have inflammatory things. For one thing, mitochondrial dysfunction, mitochondrial disease kills some cells, and then the immune system goes in there and then causes autoimmune problems. So there's always, almost always, an auto-inflammatory response, and these are great antioxidants. Here's the same, whoops, same learning objectives I've gone on before. And so the diagnosis, whole genome sequencing can tell you what you have, what your child has. You need an expert. I can do that to look at the sequence and define what's not on the report. and you need the parents if it's neurodevelopmental or a syndrome. And then treatment. Treatment can make a huge difference. Why can it make a difference? Because cations and energy metabolism are the major pathways. There are others like inflammation, neurotransmitters and things. And combination products should be designed to cover cations, energy metabolism, amino acids, neurotransmitters, inflammation, methylation, and all the other pathways. And the take-home message, which is even easier, is these are the pathways. The pathways are treatable. The treatment is mostly dietary, potassium, magnesium in the diet, good food, good supplementation. And even if you can't get supplements, the fact that there are thousands of other people that have been, I'm sorry, if you cannot get genetic sequencing because of cost, there are thousands of other people that have been sequenced, and you can use the knowledge we found on them to use products that will probably help. And this is my contact information, which I hope this will be made available. This is my new contact information because as of Saturday, we're a separate entity.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bowles. There's so many questions that have come through the Q&A. So I
Okay.
hope you're ready and have a couple extra
I am
minutes to
ready
hang
and I
with
have
us.
time.
Okay.
I always have at least a half hour to an hour afterwards because I tend to run over.
Okay. And we will take this information. I also put my contact information in the chat. So feel free to email me and I can make sure that you get this information or you can take a screenshot of this right now so you can get in touch with Dr. Bowles. It might be helpful while you have this up and are just mentioning, I know we have some international families that are here, and I was curious if you could just briefly share a little bit about your peer-to-peer program and how that works, because you are a pediatrician, so you can't necessarily see, and there's
Okay.
restraints with different states and stuff like that. So how do you go about handling that?
I try to do as much as I can help everyone and stay out of jail at the same time. Okay. I've spoken to a lot of lawyers, and so this is the solution that I've come up with. I need to be able to practice medicine in the jurisdiction the patient is at the time that I practice medicine. So you can cross state lines or you can cross international borders. It's where the patient is that matters. It doesn't matter where I am, and it doesn't matter where the parent is. It matters where the patient is, even if the patient's only on for a few minutes. That's what matters. So today, until the end of this year, we're still legally in the pandemic. I can practice medicine in all 50 states and territories. So if the patient is in the United States, anywhere in the US, territories or possessions, I can do a Zoom call. And I can do the medical care and I can order it. Since the pandemic is going to run out on January 1st, medications are a little bit problematic at this time. And I'm hoping that I can help, but somebody local can prescribe. Before the pandemic, what people were doing is they were driving to a state in which I was licensed. I am licensed in California, Arizona, Florida, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And I'm doing my best to get a Texan license. Texas is making it very difficult. They want the information from when I trained 30 years ago that doesn't exist anymore. But other than that, I'm trying to get a Texas license. So they're like, he trained here 35 years ago? Yeah, like, right, we've got this stuff. It's like, and the Texas needs it, whatever. So people can drive or fly to those states. A lot of people, like from Minnesota, yes, I have nothing in the Midwest. It gives them an excuse to go to Florida. A lot of
If
people do.
you're an adult because you're a pediatrician, then do they need to access your peer-to-peer
There was the
program?
adult thing. Okay. If they are over 30 years of age, meaning their 30th birthday is today, not yet, not tomorrow, I need to do it with another doctor, an adult doctor that's licensed in that jurisdiction. So I do a lot in the peer-to-peer system. So what I do is the doctor is the doctor and they're the ones that prescribe and everything, but I can get the clinical information. I can read the whole genome. I can help the doctor to order the test and we can go over on a Zoom call with the doctor and the family on the Zoom call that can ask questions. All of the stuff into how, you know, what the problems are that we see together. We go through the genetics together on the screen. So I have a good size screen And then I can help to try to brainstem treatment options as well. Now, internationally, it's the same thing. The only difference is internationally, the family cannot be on the call. So international, I'm trying to identify doctors that I work with in all different parts of the world. And then that doctor becomes the treating physician and then has a call with me alone. And we go over the genome and we go over the patient and we go over the treatments. So I can do any age anywhere in the world, but outside of the country, it has to be the peer-to-peer system. Inside of the country, you have to be in a state or it's in, that I'm licensed or before January 1st or peer-to-peer system. So I can do anyone anywhere with some caveats. And Liz
Okay.
is the person to contact. This is going to change again. This is her last name, but she got married 2 weeks ago. So if this email is for today. When we update it, I will give that to you. Liz Vahey, and then that's me, and the C is for clinic at gmail.com. And so if you just take a screenshot of that, that would be the best thing if anyone's interested. And for NeuroNeeds products, if you're interested, it's just neuroneeds.com. Of course, you don't need the rest of this just to put it in the browser.
Lovely. All right. So if I'm gonna let you, you can keep that screen up for a second. I'm gonna ask you a question,
Okay.
and then we'll go to and then we'll go ahead and unshare the screen just so our faces are bigger and people can see you talk a little
Yeah.
bit better. But I did want to, while we're talking about NeuroNeeds and supplements, a patient did ask, you know, what should you do when the mito cocktail is too nauseating, or you have you know, you have other chronic issues, like every time you try to take the cocktail. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Side effects of the cocktail are, I mean, okay, anything by mouth can cause nausea, anything in the stomach. So I always say with everything, with everybody, start low, go slow. If you start with one capsule, adults need five capsules twice a day of energy needs. There's 40 active ingredients I couldn't put into one capsule. There's no magic bullet, you know. Start low, work your way up. If your kid has a lot or you have a lot of nausea, then go even slower. If you want to get things up quickly and nausea is not a problem, you can go up faster. If you feel over-energized, you can go a little bit slower. And there's ways that to slow that down as well. I have another product called CalmNeeds that can be used to increase inhibitory neurotransmitters in someone that has like social or test anxiety. They can still take a test. They can take a calculus test, but it just, you know, reduces the anxiety and they can still drive to the test. And that can help balance it out if they feel too energized on energy needs or spectrum needs. But I've never seen a side effect that is irreversible. In other words, you stop the medication, it doesn't go away quickly. And I've never seen a side effect which is severe. Nausea and over-energized. Some people, if you take it, I do suggest take it when you get up and at night because it's easier to remember. Some people, when you take it at night, might be a little over-energized and not be able to sleep. So I say take it at dinner. A couple patients I've ever seen have had to take the second dose when they get home from school, like at 3 p.m., so then they can fall asleep 6 hours later. But there really are no other side effects of this. I mean, there's always idiosyncratic. Everyone can react to anything in any way different. We're all individuals. But that's what, always start low, go slow. If you have medications and if you have a lot of medical problems, it's best to have a physician be involved in that. That is not just a get out of jail free card, although it is. I mean, it's to also it's realistically is that if you're a very complex situation, you probably want to do it under medical supervision.
Yeah, I mean, it's always good for everybody to kind of be on the same page, your entire medical team. And I think a lot of our families here have multiple people on their teams. So it's good for them to be aware of what they're taking, all of what they're taking, because sometimes, you know, like there's side effects that you don't even realize, things that, you know, interact with each other and stuff. So it's always good. There's a question.
I try to make the product so that people can take them online and I can't force them to talk to their physician. I try to make it so it's harmless and everybody, regardless of the situation. But I cannot anticipate every possible combination.
All right, so if you can unshare your screen now, I'm going to
Okay.
ask a couple more questions. One patient asked, why are symptoms episodic with cyclic vomiting syndrome, and maybe just in general with different mitochondrial dysfunction? We always wondered if it were due to fighting a virus. We've tried to figure it out. Why are there some good days and some bad days? What are your thoughts on that?
There's three types of patterns. There's the clockwork pattern, like I showed you with Ryan. The biological clock, the molecular clock, is in the mitochondria. So if the mitochondria is not working right because it has a lot of free radicals and everything, I imagine that damages the clock, but that's a guess. There is the second pattern is the stress pattern. People get it when they're before they go on a vacation or before a test or when they get a viral infection or they didn't sleep all night long because they're at a sleepover or something like that. Stress can be positive, even more than negative in these cases. That I think is just because they had high energy demands and it put them in the cycle. They were just getting by otherwise, and then you put in high energy demands and they go into that cycle. I can tell you why people go into the cycle, at least it's a theory that's not published. It's up to others, of course, to prove it. I don't know why the body can reset it. If I can figure out why the body can reset the cycle, it would be a perfect treatment, right? So if anyone has any ideas, please do tell me. And then there's the one that happens at random. No one knows why, just suddenly out of the blue it happens. Well, I have no idea there. It might have been some stressor that we don't know about, like a lot of viral infections. A lot of the times I have a patient, in fact, this just happened last week. I got an email from someone, kid's doing really, really well in normal high school and has almost no symptoms. No one knows that she's a problem, which is becomes a problem in and of itself because people see she's on these supplements and the doctors say, well, she's totally normal kid, but you get the idea. And then she started having all these symptoms out of the blue and the mom didn't figure it out. And I said, well, it's usually a viral infection. So you do a blood test and you figure out, oh, the white count is low and the lymphocytes are low. Yeah, it's a viral infection, but it didn't cause a common cold type thing, so you never notice.
Would many of these patients benefit from IVIG, regardless of their immune workup? And also, is subcutaneous IG a good alternative to IVIG, or is it much less effective?
The thing with IVIG, I have a lot of patients on IVIG, including one of those that you saw. So I'm not opposed to it whatsoever, but it's not the same as giving magnesium or potassium to somebody. It's expensive. It needs to be given by vein, so there's side effects, and there really are a lot of side effects to it. So sometimes it is a lifesaver. Sometimes it can make the difference between someone who's bedridden and having pretty much a normal life. But it's not something to be done lightly. It should be done with a very knowledgeable immunologist and after other things have been tried. So yes, a lot of my patients are on it. Yes, it helps a lot of times. How many of my patient population are on it? I don't know, maybe 15, 20%. Not rare at all, but certainly not the pancreas for everybody.
Okay. So another patient asked, they got a genetic analysis performed 10 years ago, but with no diagnostic results. Is there any
But
benefit to
10
having
years
this
ago,
redone?
file that with your taxes from 10 years ago. And get retested. People say that about 3 years ago or so. What depends on what was done. Whole genome is over 99% of the genome. We can't, there's about 1% or so that we're having a hard time reading. Exome is less than 1% of the genome. Clinical exome is even less than that. And you probably need the parents if there's any neurodevelopmental issues. And then did they really look at the back end of the computer? So yeah, 10 years ago.
But
That was the dark ages.
they should be able to reevaluate that data technically, right? Because the genome is
You
the genome,
could, but
or
what would it use would it be?
okay.
I mean, you're spending a lot of time looking at less than 1% of the DNA.
So you're saying that the test should probably be rerun in
Right.
general.
I mean, if you're in the United States, Variantics is now having a price for $2,100 can do a trio genome, all three. It's actually $2,100 for just doing the patient as well. So
Oh,
the
wow.
patient and including the parents for free, it's $2,100. They'll do the whole genome. Obviously, there's interpretation costs and everything, and these things are not cheap. But if you can avoid the copay of just one or two emergency room visits, it pays for itself. Insurance companies should be wanting to pay for this technology. They're just not very smart. And you can quote me on that.
My. So this kind of goes along with the testing. Is there a test specifically for oh my gosh, the word, the cetacean that you were talking about, the Oh, Caton, the Caton channels. I always look at that word and I want to say with the C, I want to pronounce it softly, but the Caton channels, like outside of like genetic testing and you looking at the genetics and saying, okay, this is what's malfunctioning, is there any other way to test to see what's going on with the Caton
No.
channels? Okay.
There's no other way in the entire world. There's negotiations that have been started, or at least anticipate, there's contemplation of setting up a test for that alone. But at this point, there's nothing.
Do you have any experiences with low-dose naltrexone helping cyclic vomiting syndrome?
It's very good for a lot of people with any functional symptomatology, and probably half my patients are on it. It's not like it's you get to disease by many different things, many different genes, many different environments, and you treat disease with many different things. I didn't talk about exercise, critically important in chronic fatigue, but can't be too much, just right. Important for mitochondrial dysfunction or mitochondrial disease. Diet. Avoidance of toxins like Tylenol and alcohol and vitamins with iron. Sometimes you need iron, but if you don't need the iron, don't take it. I mean, there are, good sleep hygiene. There are, and I mean, low dose naltrexone will do some, not a lot, but it's part of a good comprehensive treatment plan. The patients that get better have diet, sleep, exercise, avoid toxins, take multiple supplements. I mean, the patients that really do better, like the ones that were chronic fatigue and were bedridden and now are living pretty much normal lives. They're not athletes, they don't run marathons, but they can do a job, they can have social life, they can have kids, they can be married, I mean, they get there by a little here, a little there. That's how they got to disease, and that's how they have to get to health. And LDN, low dose naltrexone, is one of the many things that can help in some.
So, when we're talking about specific supplements, there's actually two questions that have come in regards to the ubiquinol and tolerating it. One patient had issues with having like heart palpitations and like a flushing afterwards, and another patient said that both times that they've tried it, their cortisol is tanked, but they also have primary adrenal insufficiency. And do you have any thoughts on either of those or both of those?
Those sound pretty idiosyncratic type situations, that everyone has something different. I mean, those are not something that I've seen very often or whatever. There are some people that just can't tolerate it, and we just don't know why, even at low dosage, or they can only tolerate a very small number amount. Some of those seem to have, there's one thing we didn't talk about. It's a MitoSwab. It's another company. It's Reliogen. If you just put MitoSwab, all as one word, MitoSwab, the MitoSwab Plus can often be very helpful to me. There are some people that their electron transport chain activities are not low, but they're high. And so giving a mitochondrial cocktail just makes them higher. And that's not good. They get disease because probably all the free radicals that their overactive mitochondria are doing. In those patients, what I use is I use antioxidants that do not stress that do not make more energy. CoQ makes more energy. Riboflavin, vitamin C make more energy. But like quercetin and NAC, N-acetylcysteine, are great antioxidants that do not make more energy.
Okay.
So that might be the answer in those cases. And the other ones, the ones with the heart palpitations, I hope that they've discussed that with their doctor and then have gotten cardio monitoring to see if they may have a heart problem every day that becomes more of a problem during CoQ, because that may need something that needs to be treated. It may even be something that's significant.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. It's another good reason, right? To continue to try to have open conversations with your doctors, although recognizing that sometimes it's hard, with the it can be hard, right? Patient care can always ha have its challenges.
And I could speak for 8 hours, and there'd be so many important things I didn't say. You really need a physician who understands all of this. I'm going to make a plug for natural physicians. You can call, some of them are naturopaths, most of them are MDs. These are people that are integrative. They use functional medicine, but they also use allopathic, or what most people would consider, standard medicine. They will use drugs when they need to, but they prefer to use nutrition, and they're not afraid of using supplements. They're not afraid of acupuncture. They're not, but they're also not afraid of medical technology. I mean, they're integrative. They take the best from everything. They're not way out there on one side that believes in crystals, sorry. And they're not, that crystal power will do it alone. And they're not way out on the other side that it's, anything that you do that is not a drug company and double blind studies is you're poisoning the patient and you're a kook. They're in the middle and they take the best of both. There's integrated people in the autism community. They're the MAPS doctors. If you just put MED, MED, and then put MAPS, MAPS, you'll find them. And then in the functional community, like cyclic vomiting syndrome, they're often called functional doctors or integrative doctors. They go by a lot.
So while we get back to the cyclic vomiting topic specifically, a patient asked, in your cases, are there patterns of age of onset, like postpartum, early childhood, reemergence at particular times?
There seems to be three different ones from what I've seen. They're the ones that are preschool, usually age three or so, although some of them could be even in the delivery room. A lot of the ones I see as a pediatrician are the early ones. And then the other ones that I see a lot of are at puberty. And puberty these days can be at 8 or 9. At the very beginning of biochemical puberty can occur, which is usually 2 years or so before you see anything. Can also occur at 13 or 14 or so. So you're getting the middle-aged kid, middle school kids mostly, a little bit younger, a little older is okay. And then there's a third group that is in adulthood. And though it could be in any age at all, but it seems to be three peaks. And as a pediatrician, I usually see there's the preschoolers, and then there's the ones at puberty. But it can occur anywhere from birth until I've seen people at 60 years got it for the first time.
Are any of the channelopathies autosomal dominant?
They all are dominant, but they're dominant in a polygenic, multifactorial way that has non-penetrance. You can have people with the channel that don't have symptoms and variable expressivity. It's very common. I'm a geneticist. I check the whole genetics of the family many times. You'll have someone with a channelopathy with no symptoms. You'll have someone with severe disease, and most of them are somewhere in between, anywhere in between. Usually the patient is the most severe because they went to me, that one, not somebody else in the family. But I have had cases before there's a cousin that's worse or something like that. But it usually they came, the patient came to me because of the most severe. So usually they're less in the family members just because of that ascertainment bias. But they can be anywhere on there. And one person, like with a calcium channelopathy, one person can have mostly anxiety and autism. Another one can have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. And another one can have migraine and interstitial cystitis. So, I mean, to me, it's all the same disease, but to everyone else, it looks like random things in the family and there's no pattern.
Well, I'm going to take one more question, and then if your question was not answered, just know that you can feel free to contact us. We'll make sure that you get in touch with Dr. Bowles. There was a patient that asked about what do you think about the keto diet for a complex four deficiency?
The ketogenic diet is easier to do than IVIG, and it's certainly cheaper, but it's also one of those things that has its place. I'm personally on one, so I'm not going to say bad things about it. But if you have certain fatty acid oxidation disorders, it could be deadly. So it's got to be used in a mito context very carefully. It's great for complex one. It's great for pyruvate dehydrogenase. And it's really good for some of the ones that are more polygenic. But it really has to be used in a careful situation. What I prefer is the Paleolithic, which I call the caveman diet, because I'm a pediatrician. I tell these kids, do not eat if you can't pick it off the ground or hit it over the head. And then I make some allowances for dairy because dairy is a great way to get protein, which these kids really need without killing something. So yes, I'm an animal lover too. I'm not a vegan, but anyway, I, you know, I, you know, it is, dairy, eggs, things like that. High protein, again, caveman diet. They'll pick it off of trees, they'll dig it out of the ground, they'll hit it over the head. They will not go to the grocery store and they will not get it out of a wrapper.
I mean, I think you bring a really excellent point. I feel like we have these conversations often in support group that, what is really good for one patient can be deadly to another. Because my colleague's on keto, my son has LCHAD, and so he's on a very, very low fat diet. And so we talk about that all the time, how everybody's body is different and how his diet would hurt her and her diet would hurt him. And so it's why it's
Right.
so important to know what exactly is going on in your body. But it's also where the frustrating thing is when you're in the diagnostic journey and you haven't been able to figure it out quite yet. Like that is really challenging because diet is one thing that you feel like you can, help with. And so to try to, but it is, like your explanation there, like, working with the whole foods is always the better option. So,
Because that's what we're meant to eat. And I mean, you said, well, you want fruit, you want vegetables, you want meat, and you're even making an exception for dairy. Assuming cavemen did go around squeezing cows, but anyway, but what are you taking out of that? The processed foods and the grains. You're reducing the grains and you're doing more whole grains, less, because whole grains you can find. Cavemen did find whole grains. It's just they didn't process them. So that's really what I mean. You're if you do that, then you're eating a good diet, and you're probably okay with almost any disorder. Okay, if you have kidney failure, maybe all those fruits and vegetables are not the best thing because of the potassium. So you really do need to talk to your doctor. But I mean, that's really a point here. But I mean, if you eat well, for almost everybody, that's going to make life better in many ways, well beyond mito.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bowles. We really appreciate your time. We appreciate you sharing about your research and the time that you take with the patient community and answering our questions and just and all that you do. And I hope that everyone that is watching today, I hope that you'll, take the time to talk with your doctor a little bit about some of the questions that you have, some of the things that came up in regards to genetics, food, specifically what's going on with you or your child's condition. And we really appreciate everyone's participation and willingness to ask questions and be here today. So until next month.
Oh, you're welcome. And should I put the plug in for the Mito Action? You want to talk about the Mito Action meeting in Detroit?
Oh, yeah. So we have a fatty acid oxidation conference in Detroit, and Dr. Bowles will be there with us to talk that Friday. So we're very excited. So come and join us. Until next time, we will see you soon. Take
Right,
care.
bye.